here's the outline of my talk. Basically split it into three sections. First, I'll be talking about just the background of SGRs, what they are, what makes them a class of unique objects. Next, I'll be talking about the burst properties, some recent observations we have there. First, I'll describe typical bursts. I'll talk about statistical properties of these ordinary bursts. I'll talk about the giant flares, and then what I'm calling unusual bursts. For the second part, I'll talk about flux and pulse profile changes, mostly about the source SGR 1900 plus 14, and I'll also discuss the two other galactic SGRs. I'll also talk about correlations of the flux changes and pulse profile changes with the burst activity, and implications these observations have specifically for the giant flare from one of these sources. Next, and then finally, I'll talk about spin-down changes in two galactic SGRs and discuss some of the similarities they have, at least in their spin properties, with at least one anomalous X-ray pulsar. And then I'll talk briefly about some future observations of SGRs and what they might tell us about these sources. Okay, so first off, soft gamma repeaters, as a class, are defined by the recurrent burst emission. These bursts typically have durations of order 10th of a second. They can reach super Eddington luminosities upwards of 10 to the 42 ergs per second. And on rare occasion, they do emit so-called giant flares, which have higher peak luminosities up to 10 to the 44 ergs per second. And they also have longer durations, which are of order minutes. We know that they're slowly rotating, magnetized, more than likely neutron stars. They have spin periods between 5 and 8 seconds, and they're always observed, at least so far, to be spinning down. They are also associated with persistent X-ray sources with luminosities of 10 to 34, 35 ergs per second. And the popular thinking these days is that they're believed to be magnetars, that is, neutron stars with very strong magnetic fields, which I'm sure you've heard about earlier from Rob and Chris. Okay, so this is a typical burst. Lasts about a tenth of a second. Sometimes they have complex structure, sometimes they don't. But they almost always have fairly constant temperatures of order 20 to 30. KeV when fit to an optically thin thermal Bremsstrahlung spectrum, and they have very high peak intensities, well above the classical Eddington limit. The energy distribution of SGR events follows a power law distribution for. For three of the events, we're quite sure of, but we have fairly good statistics. That's SGR 1627 minus 41, 1806 minus 20, and this source, 1900 plus 14, the three galactic sources. We only have a dozen or so events from the 0526 source, the source in the Large Magellanic Cloud. So it's not certain what that distribution looks like. But the energy distribution for this source and the others follows a power law of order minus 5/3, which is consistent with what is seen in earthquakes. Earthquakes, the energy distribution there obviously scaled down much lower in energy, but follows a power law of minus 5/3. This was first pointed out by Chang et al. In their 1995 Nature paper for 1806 minus 20. Okay, now just to show you what a giant flare looks like, this is the famous March 5th event from SGR 526 minus 66, where you can clearly see this 8-second periodicity in the tail of the event. The peak reached about 5/10 of the 44 ergs per second, and this event was very similar to a flare from 1900 plus 14. Recorded on August 27th. The only difference really is the frequency of the modulations during the tail. In this case, it was 5.16 seconds, We also have much higher quality data for this flare, and we can see during the flare there was a pulse profile change, which I'll discuss in greater detail later.
Now, some of the new stuff from the SGR bursts, at least, is the detection of these so-called hard events. This is what I would call is an unusual burst, or in this case, two bursts from 1900 plus 14. These events were very different from the usual bursts in a number of ways. First off, in duration, they're a good bit longer. They last about a second each. We know that they're coincident with the SGR based upon their location in the sky. It corresponds very well with the radio location. They also have a very strongly evolving spectrum through the burst. This is the photon index as a function of time, and you can see there's an anti-correlation with intensity. So as the source reaches the maximum, the photon index becomes steeper, and then it becomes harder during the tail of the burst. These events also have a time integrated spectrum, which is much harder than the 20-30 keV OTTV.
Can I ask a question? Up to which energies these bursts were observed?
In BATSE, we detected them up to about half an MeV. And the comparable OTTB temperature, although it's not a very good fit, is about 100 keV. So when you compare these events to the classical gamma ray bursts, there really isn't much of a difference, at least in terms of the hardness ratio, in the hardness duration plane. These are you can clearly see the two groups of sources, the hard short class of gamma ray bursts and the long soft class of gamma ray bursts, and these fall sort of in between, but they're clearly not distinguishable from the gamma ray burst based upon these properties alone. What really sets them apart is obviously their location. Located close. They were consistent with 1900 plus 14. They were close to the plane, and their spectral evolution was unusual as compared to other gamma ray bursts.
Can I actually ask a question?
Yes.
So, given that you've seen somebody with BATSE, it's not the 1 in 10 to the 4, 1 in 1,000 bursts that are just coincident?
No, we...
Well, I'm asking for the probability of seeing a gamma ray burst in the air box.
Right.
It's community, right, for BATSE.
They were seen
during an active time period. The size of the air box, we have an IPN location. It's not a BATSE air circle. So it's an IPN.
Okay.
It's an IPN location.
For these guys.
Yeah. So it's a narrow slice,
okay.
And if you just threw them at random on the sky, the chance probability is like 10 to the minus 6 for both of them.
For BATSE, it's order of unity.
Yeah. For BATSE, it is of order of unity.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So that's one type of unusual burst. Another type, which I find is I believe an unusual burst, and they seem to be a class of events which spans different levels of bursting activity and different sources, are these smooth long events. Unlike the hard events, I mean they are long like the hard events, but they are similar in spectrum to the short events. These are two events from 1900 plus 14. This one was recorded on August 29th. This one on October 28th, and then this one from 1627-41, a different source. Obviously very similar in temporal structure as well as similar in spectrum. They didn't show any significant spectral evolution through the burst. And in the case of this one, which I'll talk about a little bit later, it has a very long X-ray tail observed with the PCA. So these events are sort of, they're certainly on the bright end of the burst energy spectrum, but they are well below the giant flare class by about two orders of magnitude. And I really don't have a great explanation for what these events are. I'll leave that to Rob and Chris to discuss. But I just really want to raise awareness that there are other events out there. It's more than just the short soft events and the giant flares. There's more to it in the SGRs, which suggests there's more than just a couple physical processes going on to create
exactly
these bursts.
How rare are these events?
In the case of, probably of order a percent, because in the BASSI database, we have two events recorded from 1900, and there were 200 total from the bursting active period in 1998, and then here we have one out of 100.
And was anything like this seen in all the hundreds of bursts in 1806?
In 1806, I'm not sure.
No.
Kristen says no. In 0526, there were at least a couple events. This was reported, I'm glad you mentioned it, I forgot to mention this. This was reported by Golinetsky in his 1984 Nature paper. There was an 8.5 second long flare, which was similar in temporal structure to this one, as well as a 3.5 second one, I believe. So we've seen it in at least a few SGRs, and they appear to be rare.
It seems like you could argue that these are the very high energy end of the short soft bursts.
It's not just an intensity dependence, because we have other intense, we have more intense bursts from, I know from 1900 plus 14, which do not have this long duration and smooth profile.
Higher fluence.
Higher intensity.
Okay.
Higher intensity and in one case, higher fluence. Yes.
The same in 1627. The CONUS results indicate that in June 18, when this event was recorded, there was yet another burst that was just as intense but not so intense.
This is a very soft event. This is a 20-30 kV. Then there's a hard event, which is just about 10% brighter.
There's six recorded in June 18, and I wasn't sure which one this was. But there is a hard event and a soft event, which is
comparable in intensity, but completely different in terms of spectrum.
It does seem to be kind of a continuity, I think, between the fluence that you go through, but then there are also the outliers that are soft and intense.
Well, I think one thing to keep in mind is that the short 10-second bursts, the spectrum, fairly similar to the extended pulsating tails of the giant flares.
Also similar to the spectrum.
Yeah, so I think the case can be made that the radiative mechanism is fundamentally similar in all three cases. We're just dealing with the difference in scale and the amount of energy being released, maybe the volume and the proportion of the neutron star that's active.
But what I would expect is more of a continuum, rather than a discrete jump in say duration, which is what I believe is happening here. I mean, you don't have the intermediate events, half a second. It appears to go to a large jump in terms of duration, at least in the gamma rays.
That raises the question: what triggers these flares?
It's also matter of sampling. If you study that for many years, you get many more.
I'd like to see, to be sure that this is a real thing we're talking about.
Okay,
yeah, that would be a good thing to check.
Well, I mean, the thing that you kept in mind is that, this is probably obvious to people, these are long enough that they're becoming comparable in duration to the spin period of the source. A little bit less, but. So some of the structure could represent equal rotational modulation.
Sure.
Whereas
sure.
In the very short 10-second burst, that's not likely to be the case.
Right. Okay. So now I'd like to speak about there's actually a precursor here, which you can't really see on this scale, but it's very significant in the PCA data, and for the PCA spectrum, it was found by Stromer and Ibrahim that there's evidence for an emission line around 6.5 keV during the first portion of this precursor, and some recent developments. There's been a notice that came out on the XD webpage about the response for that particular observing mode, and I'm not sure if it affects these results, but apparently...
Very good to mention that I talked with Ferguson this morning, and he said he really checked.
He checked into it.
And it seems that the line persists.
It doesn't matter, okay.
Produce a BHA file and send it to KPI board,
okay.
And then you can double check.
But then you have the line itself appears to be about 4 sigma then.
Is that any more significant than the line that's between 10 and 20 keV?
That line, the estimated significance is about 2.8 keV, or sigma, so it's marginal.
Yeah, but it's exactly
twice
the energy.
It's twice the energy.
It doubles the significance.
What's that? The centroid is consistent with cold iron. But then, as Rob pointed out, there's this other feature which is marginally significant at twice the energy.
If it's a proton cyclotron, two harmonics, it's 3 times 10 to the 15 Gauss proton harmonic. Or it could be ion harmonics and it could be an ion cyclotron harmonic and a proton, both in the fundamental, which would then be like 3 times 10 to 15 Gauss.
So this is the continuum spectrum, which is, I believe, OTTB, and then these are the residuals.
Optically
thin thermal from Schlung, sorry. So DND is 1 over E to the minus E over KT. And we have, so this is the continuum, and then these are the residuals for the first portion of that precursor. And there's significant excess here and a marginally significant excess here. It's consistent, the width is consistent with the instrumental intrinsic width, so it's consistent with being a narrow line feature. Yes.
Is this Chandra?
This is XD-PCA.
XD?
PCA, yeah.
The locations 1 plus 2, 3 plus 4 plus 5.
They correspond to, I've got a spare. So this is the precursor, the light curve of the precursor. And the line is seen in the first two sections here, and then it disappears. And then after this is the big burst, which is much brighter by an order of magnitude than this precursor.
In the cyclotron interpretation, you could have the magnetospheric emission shining down on the surface could pump these lines radiatively, and you see the transition. And then it would have to cut off for some reason. It's like you would ablate an outflow that comes off, you think, or something.
Pete, you know the governor division in this light curve?
He chose the sections based upon equal number of counts to get about the same statistics in each bin.
Can I make a short comment about that second line? I think that any explanations of it as a second harmonic or a harmonic of the proton cyclotron line is absolutely unrealistic, because always you have mc squared in the denominator when you calculate
it.
And this means that it would be never seen. Although, of course, it can be any other ion, like iron or helium or whichever is a mass to Z to A ratio.
Right, then you have to get up to higher field. If the field isn't like 2, that's what I'm saying.
But in any case, we've only had this in one event, and we really like to find this more. We've got 1,000 events to look through, so.
Yeah, actually, of course, the second line, I know, you can just look at many observational spectra and see a lot of such quasi lanes, which are just some.
Yeah, right.
I was pointing it out as a possibility.
Yes.
So at least you're interested in it. So I accomplished my goal. All right. So that about sums it up for the odd burst. We have the smooth long events, which it needs to be quantified better, but appear to be distinct from the short events, at least in temporal structure. And then we have the hard events, which are certainly distinct in terms of their spectrum, and the this line feature, which is very interesting and needs to be investigated further for the whole ensemble of SGR bursts. So now moving on to the flux histories. In general, the flux histories of SGRs are fairly sparse. We only get about one observation with imaging X-ray instruments per year. And we know that in the case of 1900 plus 14, during its active period in 1998, it was found that the persistent flux level increased by a factor of 2.5. Now, we have a number of PCA observations during this time interval, but unfortunately for the PCA, it's not an imaging instrument, and it suffers from source confusion. We know there are at least two other X-ray transients in the field of view, so you can't make an unambiguous flux determination just based upon the PCA observations. What we can do with them is measure the pulse intensity of the source. And we know from a sequence of four SACS observations taken at varying flux levels that in all cases, the pulse fraction remained constant. So if you assume that the pulse fraction remains constant throughout the time interval, then a measurement of the pulse intensity translates directly to a measurement of the net source intensity.
So for this, you mean the persistent X-ray source, the pulse fraction, that persistent one has a constant pulse fraction?
Right, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So this is the main result. The middle panel gives the flux history of the SGR over the last 4.5 years. The top panel is the burst rate history as observed with BATSE. And the bottom is the pulse fraction as a function of time over the same interval as observed with SACS, the SACS NFI. And as I mentioned earlier, it's consistent with remaining constant at about 11%. Now, for determining the normalization between the pulse flux measurements, which are given in the scales given on the right, and the absolute source flux measurements given on the left, we noted that prior to burst activity, in the ASCA observation here and the SACS observation here, they were consistent with one another. So we assumed that the source flux remains constant in periods of quiescence, in the absence of burst activity. So we took the 1996 PCA observation and took the ratio of that measurement, the pulse measurement, to the source flux measurement from the SACS observations less than a year later, and used that as a normalization factor to correct the subsequent pulse flux measurements. And we found that it was a good choice of normalization because we've got very good agreement of subsequent simultaneous observations here, where we've got an ASCA and a SACS point and numerous PCA points, and then here in the spring of 2000. Now, there are a few things I'd like to point out about the changes in the flux history here. First off, the first detection of a significant deviation was in June of 1998, and this was after some normal recurrent burst activity, but before the giant flare, so this shows that these normal bursts do affect the persistent emission of the source. And then we have this very bright spike following the August 27th flare, which I'll discuss more in a minute, and then we have the slowly decaying tail after and during much of this residual burst activity, and then we have recovery of the source intensity in the spring of 2000. And not only did the flux of the source recover, but also the spectral form. And from the SACS observations in May of 97, prior to burst activity, we found that a simple power law did not provide an adequate fit to the data. We had to include a black body, a two-component spectrum to fit the data. And during the burst active interval, namely this observation here, we found that the black body component was washed out. We only needed the power law component. And now following the flux enhancement, we find that the black body component is once again visible. And this becomes important later. It's visible at the same relative fraction to the power law flux. So focusing now on the data following the August 27th flare. If we plot those flux values in log-log space relative to the onset of that flare, we find that they follow very nicely a power law in time. this power law has an exponent of minus 0.7. And if we extrapolate this power law back towards the flare itself, we find that it comes into relatively good agreement with the ASM measurements first reported by von Remlard et al. Shortly after the flare. This discrepancy, this is a significant discrepancy up here, can be accommodated if you change the epoch, your T-naught. If you change it to somewhere more near the end of the flare, then that affects the T-minus T-naught value of this point more than it'll affect these points. It doesn't affect these points at all, actually, that significantly. And this zoomed-in region here was just used to show the good agreement that we have between the Sachs and Aska points and the PCA points.
So here's T naught at the beginning of the flare.
T naught is the start of the flare.
Yeah, it might be useful to just take the end, because there is a pretty sharp cut.
Yeah, I can use that as a free parameter in the fit and see what it comes out to be. Yeah. I believe the best fit was 8 minutes. So a couple minutes past the end of the flare appeared to be the best fit to the data.
I see.
Okay, now going back to the August 29th flare, so this actually shows the picture a little more clearly. Probably should have shown this picture first. This is that precursor with the 1, 2, and then 3 through 6 intervals right here. So this is the beginning of the precursor where we see the line. This is the Batsy light curve showing the main event. And then following it, we see in the PCA there's this long tail which extends on to at least 1,000 seconds beyond the time of the flare, the burst. And in this tail, we find a similar temporal index, consistent with the index that we find for the giant flare of minus 0.8. plus or minus 0.1. But as I said, this flare was spectrally similar to the normal recurrent burst, unlike the giant flare, which has a very hard initial spike. It's not clear yet whether these tails are spectrally similar, but we can certainly say that the temporal behavior is similar between the two. Which may be suggestive of a similar mechanism, but it's not clear.
What are the durations of those two spikes that I see superimposed on that tail?
Well, the binning here is too coarse to really resolve those spikes,
so
but you can.
Is this an artifact of the binning?
No. Those are real bursts.
Yeah.
Those are just bursts superimposed on this tail. The normal.
So are they like the short bursts then?
Yeah, they're just like the regular. They're just like the regular bursts, except they're located on the tail.
Okay.
What are those spikes?
Yeah.
Two spikes.
Yeah.
What are they?
They're just these normal bursts, except they happen to occur during the tail of this flare.
Oh, really?
Mm, short duration burst. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the spectrum you have there, it's the PCA spectrum. It only goes up to what energy?
Up to about 60 keV or so, above which the effective area drops off by quite a bit.
I see. Okay. So it's consistent with last.
But it's consistent with an OTTB of order, if I remember correctly, 30 keV
in the tail.
For the spectrum of the tail of the August 27 flare, we've only investigated the 2 to 10 keV spectrum, and for that we find a power law. But those two could be perfectly consistent with one another, since we're only looking over a very narrow energy range for the August 27th flare data, at least thus far. If you look at just a small area, you could just see the local slope as opposed to the continuum for the PCA. This extends to a much larger range.
Do you have PCA spectrum
for that? We haven't analyzed those yet.
For this
event we have, but not for the August 27th flare.
Right,
data.
For this one,
when you're talking about the August 27th.
When I talk about the August 27th flare, I'm talking about the afterglow, this power law decay phase of the flare.
This one is up to 60 kV, so the OTTB fits up to 60 kV, right?
Yes.
Right, so if you try to fit that with the black body, it would be very poor. Yeah, okay.
And that's why, in the Ibrahim paper, down here,
he fit a black body plus a parallel. You know, a simple black body would not fit the data.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. The black body component of his fit. What was the temperature there? Do you remember?
I don't know.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. So this is the flux history of I've just talked about the flux history of this particular source, 1900 plus 14. Now I'd like to discuss the pulse profile changes that we see. These are sequence of pulse profiles, 0 to 2 cycles, arbitrary flux units. The top row and the bottom row are both 2 to 10 keV. The middle row is 25 to 150 keV. These are the Ulysses data, the blue histogram of the giant flare that I showed you earlier. Now, in the top row, we have data acquired all prior to the August 27th flare. And you can see that the pulse profiles are more or less similar to one another before the flare. And I'd like to point out that this last profile was taken after a significant amount of burst activity in May and June of 1998. So the burst activity there did not have much of an effect on the pulse profile. Now, during the flare, we see a very clear change. This has been noted by other authors as well, Mazetz et al., Ferocci et al., in that at the beginning of the flare, the pulse profile was very complex. And then towards the end of the flare, the power in the higher harmonics goes away for the most part, and the profile becomes more simple. This same qualitative behavior can be seen in the persistent emission of the source. The bottom row were taken from data all following the flare. So this first profile was during the quote-unquote afterglow of the August 27th flare when the source was decaying. We next have data from this slower decaying extended tail in the beginning of 1999. And then next, after the flux and the spectral form had recovered in the spring of 2000. So what we see in this source is a recovery of the flux, a recovery of the spectral form, but a non-recovery of the pulse profile.
You know what I'm going to say, but
they're completely unrelated.
I should say the intermediate panel.
Yes.
Is during the outburst when the flux is 5 orders of magnitude higher than in the upper lower panels.
Yes.
So the radiative physics is probably very different, and so I think this apparent pattern should be taken with,
But it's
really
striking, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I agree.
Wait. But it is quite striking that the complexity is reduced.
I mean, yeah.
I think they're for very different reasons. In the outburst, for example.
I mean, you could come up with two completely different reasons to explain both behaviors, but both behaviors are qualitatively similar in terms of the observation. I mean, you see the same change in the gamma rays that you see in the X-rays. And the change appears to be linked with this giant flare.
Yeah, but...
And not with intensity of the source.
I mean, to give you an example, the simplification of the pulse profile of the giant flare has a simple explanation in the fact that the firewall that's powering it is contracting. You can fit the amplitude of the pulsations very nicely with the contracting envelope for the trapped firewall. But in the persistent emission, you have nothing like that present. And so the radiative physics is entirely different.
So Chris, let me say it in the pejorative sense. You would say you would never see an evolution in the opposite direction during a flare.
There is an evolution in the opposite direction in the giant flare. But I don't want to get into that because we have a paper on that, but I can refer you to, but this it'll
the only way you can convince an observer, right? Or maybe the audience is to make if you're gonna have two explanations, then you better make a prediction that somebody else can check otherwise.
He has more than two explanations, unfortunately.
For the next giant flare? Can you use it?
Sure. Well, that's what
we're talking about.
Have the pulse profile in just before, in the precursor, compared with June 98.
In the precursor?
The giant flare.
Oh, we don't...
Different, you showed...
These are the last data that we have.
Those are the
Leading up to the giant flare.
Right, okay.
So the next observation is not till after the flare.
Okay, right.
Which starts on the 28th of August, which is right there. Yeah, so unfortunately, it would be very nice, both for the pulse profile and the timing behavior, to have an observation on the 26th, but we don't have that. Okay, well, I've already summarized that. So what happened during and after the giant flare? Well, as Chris has pointed out in his paper, which is now in press, accretion is not a viable option for this afterglow emission. If you take the radiative pressure of the giant flare itself, it would evacuate any hypothetical accretion disk out to such a large radius that the time scale over which accretion would reestablish itself on the star would be of order years, and we see emission from the source just 1,000 seconds after the flare. So at least for this afterglow emission, it's not possible. So we also know that rotation is by far insufficient to power this emission. So this points towards some new type of energy dissipation from neutron star, at least from this neutron star, to explain this afterglow emission. We can also say that the afterglow is a global phenomenon, and the argument for that is we find the pulse fraction is constant throughout the afterglow, at least in the measurements that we have. And if you were to heat a localized area of the neutron star, one would expect a large increase in the pulse fraction, and we don't see that. So one conclusion that you really have to reach in terms of the magnetar model is that you need to alter the magnetic fields during the giant flare.
And strength.
What's that?
Configuration of the magnetic field hasn't obtained, right? Just the configuration of the magnetic field.
I'll get to that point in just a second.
Yeah.
First off, Chris, the idea Chris is proposing is that there may have been a crack on the star, which created this flare, and in addition to that, a twist in the polar cap region, that twist would induce a current flowing. This current would create an optically thick scattering screen, which would scatter the radiation in phase only and not in energy. And the reason for that is we see the black body component again following the flux decay, which suggests that we're seeing the surface emission. Now, an alternative option is what you just hinted at. The magnetic field itself, the magnetic field geometry may have changed during the flare. And the argument for that is we see the black body component again, so it suggests that you're seeing the surface emission, and since the pulse profile is simplified and remains this simple sinusoid, it suggests the field structure is dipolar. The problems with this model, as Chris has pointed out, is that it's energetically very difficult to do this. You're talking about completely rearranging the star, and the energy required would exceed by a couple orders of magnitude the observed energy in gamma rays. So that's certainly a problem for this model.
The first one you explained first, that means temporarily the strength itself increased in this first explanation you explained.
No.
The field strength is still about 10 to 15 all through that.
The field strength.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's
no, it didn't change. No, it was just the creation. You need to have this scattering photosphere in order to mask the underlying field structure to keep that simple pulse profile.
About 10 to 15
All through the flare, right.
So in other words, the fuel did not change at all, or what? I cannot get...
That's one story. That's one story.
I mean, the question is, are the higher multiples, which, of course, there's very clear evidence in the profile of the giant flare, dissipated entirely during the flare, or do they remain afterwards?
And if they dissipate, you lose 10 to the 47 ergs, approximately. And the flare itself was only 10 to the 44 ergs in gamma rays. So there seems to be an energy discrepancy there.
If you're going to dissipate the exterior, you just quoted a number for the exterior field.
Right.
But if you're going to do a large redistribution like that, you're going to change the interior field as well, which is probably a bit stronger. So you need very strong interior fields in order to have ampipolar diffusion happening fast enough. And so I would say that in the Mentor model, if you're going to really rearrange things enough to make a real global reconfiguration of the field, then you're talking more like 10 to 49 ergs. Sorry for
interrupting. No, that's okay.
So once more, in the first option, the field actually doesn't change, but some scattering atmosphere is above the star, which kind of
masks
all this.
It smears out the far enough radius.
Yes, but I mean, it's not
global
changes.
There's non-detection terms induced, new currents induced.
And then in the other model, you change the geometry itself.
The second model intuitively looks very implausible.
Yeah.
Can you briefly elaborate on why accretion model is not too viable?
It's not viable. It's not viable for the afterglow emission.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is the radiative pressure during this flare, it reaches 10 to the 44 ergs per second, the peak luminosity. That's far in excess of the Eddington luminosity for a standard neutron star. So that's going to push out material to such a large radius that the time scale over which it takes for the material to move back in and be accreted onto the star would be of order years, and we see it just seconds later.
And this paper gives
in the case of the rapid burster.
Okay.
I was just going to say, in the case of the rapid burster, if you do that calculation, you know, this excavation of the inner part of the disk and the delay, you do get a delay time. So there's a case where it works, and here. Here, you know,
bursting pulsar as well. You see the same. You see dips after the burst. Yeah.
I didn't believe in that model anyway. Actually, so that's good.
What is the energy source?
The magnetic field.
What is the change of the magnetic?
Yes.
Everything is magnetic. I mean, all the energy.
Yeah. But if you say there is hardly any change in the overall configuration.
Yeah, because it feels so strong that even with this giant flare, it's only a small.
It's like in a solar flare. After the flare, the field is a little bit changed, but it's not very much.
More like a local change.
Okay, so this summarizes of what we know.
Could you go
yes,
back?
Sir.
Just
okay, sorry. Sorry. It's okay.
What caused the change in the magnetic
fields? In which model are you talking now?
Whichever.
Okay. Well, as far as the global field reconfiguration model, which I do like, but obviously is energetically unfavorable, I don't know what would change the field and cause such a large a global shift in the magnetic field geometry.
I mean,
now, as far as what Rob and Chris...
Right? I mean, it would be some magnetic instability in the interior.
Yeah, in the interior of the star, which would have to create that.
So the picture is that the field permeates the entire structure of the star.
Sure.
There is no differential any of the fields to the crust or whatever.
Oh, well, that's how you've got field inside and in the crust. And the field is so strong, magnetic stresses can break the crust. You know, when you get above 10 to 14 Gauss or so, and so that's a big difference why you get a lot of this bursting activity. But instability is driven by the magnetic field in all cases with bursting flares in the Mentor model, and the details of that are kind of what we're debating about.
But you say basically the field is not a potential field, so it wants, it still has extra energy and it wants to rearrange itself. And then it cracks the crust.
Well, it's undergoing diffusion all the time. And there's ambipolar diffusion in the interior. And in the crust, the dominant term is the Hall drift terms driving. And so as the field evolves, it goes through a sequence of equilibrium states, but it reaches visibility points.
I think we should let Peter talk about
the last 10 minutes. Okay. All right. Last 10 minutes? Okay. Let me just talk very briefly about 1806 minus 20. What we haven't done yet is look at the flux history of this SGR. We intend to apply the same technique to this source and see if there are changes in the source flux because we have a long period of bursting activity. But what we can say without a doubt is that there are pulse profile changes. We see in 1996, I don't have the burst rate history available right now, but I'll get to that in a minute. In 1996, when the burst activity was at its peak, we see this complex field structure, and then after most of the burst activity was over, we see it simplifying. So we see the same transition and what I think is important, the same direction of change, and then it's moving from something more complex to something more simple. So what's next is to look at the changes in the source flux, and we believe that there will be changes in the source flux. We see at least in one burst now, this is a recent burst from September of this year, a power law flux decay. Power law flux decay.
You don't have the spectrum yet, though.
Yeah.
We're working on that right now. We're working on that. But we do see a power law flux decay with a completely different exponent, which interestingly enough is consistent with a GRB afterglow, which I think is pretty neat, but that's about it. But it is completely different than the minus 0.7 that we find in 1900 plus 14, at least for those two bursts. And we can see it goes. What Chris pointed out, which is very interesting, it goes well beyond a rotational cycle out to 10 seconds without any evidence really for an occultation, which suggests it's not a local phenomenon. It appears to be an extended emission region. Okay, now for 1627 minus 41, we see a decay in the persistent emission of this source as well. Here, again, it's a different exponent, t to the minus 0.3, roughly. And we chose our epoch to be the peak of the burst activity. This source had a very well-defined peak, which I can show you here. The burst activity was concentrated, I think more than half the bursts were recorded in a single day, which is pretty odd, at least in the BATSE energy range, to have such clustering. This is the burst rate history as a function of time, and this is the SGR we're talking about. So you can see it's highly peaked, and we chose that as our epoch. And we see a decay in the persistent emission of this source, at least over the next 700 days. We have further Chandra observations coming up, which will tell us whether this decay is continued or it's leveled off. Okay. So just to summarize the flux decay, we have a variety of exponents and a variety of events. And for 1900, we have two decays, minus 0.7, minus 0.8, but they're consistent with one another. We have a steeper decay in 1806, minus 20, from what might be an ordinary burst. It may be harder, as Chris has just said. And then we have a minus 0.3 power law from 1627 minus 41. Okay, so moving on to the timing properties of SGRs. This summarizes what we know right now for the time properties of the four known SGRs. For 0526, we saw the 8-second pulsations in the tail of this March 5th flare from 1979. But we haven't detected the persistent pulsations yet, although there's a marginal detection reported in a recent paper by Kulkarni. For 1627, there's a marginal detection at 6.4 seconds, but this needs to be confirmed. And then for 1806 and 1900, we have a number of observations of the pulse period. Those are very secure. For 1900, we have it both during the giant flare as well as from the persistent emission. And for each, we detect very rapid spin down at times is of order 10 to the minus 11, but it becomes more rapid, which I'll show you in a minute. And we've also been able to measure the so-called timing noise parameter given, defined by delta 8, which is basically a measurement of the new double dot parameter, which tells you how much of a deviation you have from a constant spin down. And these are very high values, but I'll discuss that in a second. So first off, the 1900 plus 14 pulse period history. This was the story back from the discovery. We had just a few observations, and they fit fairly nicely to a straight line. As we got more observations, we found out that straight line was not the case. It changed by quite a bit during the summer of 1998 during the burst active interval. We're not sure if that's associated with a continuous change or a discrete change. I think Rob talked about that a couple weeks ago. We next have a period where we are unable to phase connect the data. All the individual points are frequency measurements. The continuous lines are phase connected solutions. And during this time interval, we should be able to phase connect the data, but we cannot. So that means there are very rapid changes in the torque in the system, and we do see an overall curvature, so a ramping up of the P dot. The P dot reaches the maximum, at least from the observation that we have through here, through these SACS observations, where the increase over this nominal value of 6 times 10 to the minus 11 is about a factor of 4 larger. It's about 24 times 10 to the minus 11. And then we see that this accelerated spin down has ceased, and we're back down to nearly the 6 times 10 to the minus 11 second per second value. Now for 1806 minus 20, the top panel is the burst rate history, the red histogram. We see the same sort of behavior. We see a straight line, and then we actually caught it during the transition here in 1999, where the source is beginning to ramp up, and then we see that the slope here is about a factor 4 larger than it was here.
These things are almost synchronized, aren't they?
Almost, yeah. Yeah, the 1806 followed 1900 on this one. So I'll talk about what might be causing this in a minute, but first let me show you. This is an anomalous X-ray pulsar. Anomalous X-ray pulsars are a class of sources which have a number of similarities to the persistent emission from the SGRs. They're also slow rotators between about 4 and 11 seconds. They have steep X-ray spectra. Their luminosities exceed their spin-down kinetic energy losses by orders of magnitude. And they're also believed to be magnetars by many. This is one of those sources, 1E1048-59, which also shows the same qualitative behavior where we see this sort of piecewise linear change in the p-dot. And if you put them all in the same graph, you can do that by using this so-called delta 8 parameter. You see that they all fall in roughly the same area of the diagram. So I have this delta 8 parameter, which is defined by the log of the absolute value of the new double dot times 10 to the 24 over 6 times the frequency. And then I have the log of the period derivative here on the x-axis. The black dots are radio pulsars. The inverted gray triangles are also upper limits for radio pulsars. And then all the blue points are the anomalous x-ray pulsars. The two green squares are from accreting x-ray sources. And then the red diamonds are from the SGRs. Now what we see from this is that the timing noise values of the SGRs, and at least of 1048, which is given by this square, are exceed the extrapolation of the radio pulsar trend. And they're also in the same general area of the diagram, and there appears to be possibly a trend here, in that as you move to the higher spin downs, you see the stronger timing noise. But from these data alone, you really can't rule out accretion, at least from just this information, as you can see that there are a couple sources at least that fall within this range.
Let me understand though. So when you plot new double dot for these, I mean, you have one new dot and then you have another new dot. Is new double dot plotted here really just that big change?
New double dot, the measurement...
Or is it the term you're fitting when you have otherwise piecewise smooth shot?
The term, the new double dot I'm getting here, for 1806, I got it from the transition point where it began to ramp up in terms of the spin down. And there I measured a value which translated to a delta 8 of 4.8.
So it's a local phase-connected...
It's a local phase-connected solution.
Okay. So it's not... You do a best fit of...
Yeah, it's not from the frequency measurements. It's from the phase-connected solutions to the...
Okay, let me say it this way. Let me just ask my question.
Yes.
You've got a factor 4 change in new dot.
Yes.
Over a year. So if I were blind and crude, I would say new double dot is 4 times new dot divided by a year.
Right.
And you're saying that's not what you're plotting here.
No, I'm plotting local. I'm plotting,
okay.
Plotting local,
okay.
New
so
double dots.
Okay, so that's the number that's off the plot.
It could be, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. So it could vary by, it does vary by a large
right.
amount.
Okay, but that's not what you're plotting here, is that?
No.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm plotting local values.
Okay, good.
Yeah. So just to summarize, both 1806 and 1900 have shown large variations by about a factor of 4 in some cases. Neither have shown spin up, neither display evidence for binarity. Both exhibit similar timing noise levels. Now what's causing the timing noise is really not clear to me. There's this idea that alphane wave emission induced by the bursting activity, induced by the global the seismic activity of the source, could produce enough torque to cause accelerated spin down. But one would expect in that model, at least naively, to see a correlation between the bursting activity and the increase in the spin down, which is not observed. So we see one source, 1E1048, which has no bursting activity, 1806 minus 20, which has bursting activity, no giant flare, and 1900 plus 14, which has bursting activity and a giant flare, all show the same timing behavior. So that suggests to me that it's completely unrelated to the bursting activity, which may or may not be true, but that's what it suggests to me. As far as the future of SGR research, I think Chandra and Newton observations during burst active intervals are very important. We'll only be really seeing the tip of the iceberg for these power law burst decays in the PCA. We can only really see it in the upper couple percent of the burst fluences. With Chandra and Newton, obviously we can see tails from the much dimmer bursts, and we can have a large ensemble where we can do more things with the data. We can also have more sensitive detections of the changes in the source spectrum, which we see in 1900 plus 14, which are also diagnostic of what's going on. Another thing to do is to keep up our monitoring programs. We have a spin period monitoring program of the two galactic SGRs, 1806 and 1900. Obviously, those are important. We see large changes in the spin down, which we don't yet understand, so we need to keep up with those. And then personally, I'd like to better understand the nature of the giant flares. I think from the discussions here, we can see that it's still very confusing as to exactly what's going on. We'd like to better understand the spin evolution, as I mentioned, from the monitoring campaigns, and always keep our eyes open for new SGRs. Thank you.
Am I right in thinking that there are no pulse profile changes observed in AXPs, including that one that had that?
From Vicky's talk, from what I remember last month, she saw energy dependence in at least a couple. 1048, I don't think she saw any energy dependence, if I remember correctly. And then 2259, she didn't see any energy dependence within the XT observations, but there was reports of, pulse profile changes. She didn't see any pulse profile changes in the PCA data, but I believe there were reports of that from earlier observations.
Well, there are luminosity variations in 2259.
Luminosity variations.
And maybe some modest pulse profile changes associated with it.
Spectral variations.
So nothing of this magnitude as we see in 1900 plus 14.
Right.
And as far as I can tell, not even of the magnitude that we see in 1806, at least none that I'm aware of.
Question, do any characteristics like luminosity or spectrum changes during those periods of increased P dot? Are there any correlations with anything? Okay, you talked about correlations with bursts, but many.
Well, let's see. There's really not much. Here's 1900 plus 14, where we see the largest dynamic range of flux changes. And during this period here, we've got a very nice phase-connected solution with a P dot of 5.9 times 10 to the minus 11. So it's actually, just slightly below, but within the errors of this value. And during that time interval, we see this afterglow. So we see a very large change by an order of magnitude in the flux, but we see a very constant spin down. And then here, the source flux is recovered to the quiescent level. And this is at the highest value of the spin down.
So the deviation starts at the flare, when the flare.
Yeah, that was the largest spike was associated with this flare.
Yeah.
Do you foresee any limits on the inferred magnetic fields from observations? I mean, beyond a certain value, we cannot see any more and so forth.
Based upon the observations? Like a P dot we can't measure, or? Now, as long as sequence your observations properly, you can measure P dots much larger than this. P dots are measured for accreting systems, for example, at much larger values than this by orders of magnitude. So that would infer, magnetic fields if it were magnetic breaking, 10 to the 17 or higher Gauss.
So if you don't see,
there's not a limit there. There's not an observational limit there. Yeah.
And how likely are you? Bad question.
To observe such spin down?
Less likely and more likely than others, or is it a question of chance?
Of detecting them,
yeah.
It depends on a knowledge of the radiative physics. I'm not sure that we know that well enough that we would be able to see such high field pulsars, or even if they can possibly exist. I think there's a limit discussed in Thompson and Duncan 93, right? And that's what
10 to 17
Gauss is about it.
The field can dynamically escape from the star, overcome the stable stratification on dynamical timescales when you get up to a little bit above in the second house. So,
if they emit X-rays, then we can observe.
The process making those things, you don't expect to get anything up that high. You expect to get things up to 10 to 16 Gauss at most.
Do you expect this field to
be? Is this wrong, or is this expectations? I don't know
what we will be expecting. Well, yes, certainly if you had 10 to the 18 Gauss, if you really want a firm limit, right, you need to convert all the gravitational energy to magnetic energy released in the collapse to give you 10 to the 18 Gauss. Now, what happens is in the collapse you have bulk motions, you have MHD flow, and it's working on the field and building up the field. You expect that will be very inefficient. Okay, and so, it's you certainly are going to be orders of magnitude below 10 to the 18 Gauss.
Do you expect this field to decay on the line?
Well, go ahead, Chris, you seem to want to.
Do we have any real quantitative measure of the field? Do we have now any quantitative measure of the field?
Sure. So, I mean, there's a variety of arguments.
The P dot.
Based on the giant flare alone,
I can give you six arguments for
and all of them involve
I think it's what you're referring to. We've only been observing it for 4 years.
If you believe that this.
Clearly, that's not what causing these changes, though. I mean, this is well beyond, you know, timing noise repulsor. So where exactly do you draw your line to get your PDOT for the fields? It's unclear. And we've only been observing the sources for, you know, 4 or 5 years, and we see changes in the time scale of a year by a factor of four. So
if the persistent X-ray has seismic output of the star in this vibrating star model is equal to the persistent X-ray output, then you would reduce the inferred dipole field from the magnetic dipole formula by about a factor of four. As you increase the persistent seismic output beyond the persistent X-ray output, you can reduce the dipole field further. But if you want to reduce below the QED for value, for example, you'd have to have 10 to 37 Earth per second or more coming out persistently.
How much energy is there in the spin down here, and energy loss, for example?
10 to 33.
10 to 33.
Okay, so that's small.
Yeah, very small. Yeah. But going back to the seismic activity argument, that also is used to explain the burst emission. You've got an increase in the seismic activity, and presumably you have an increase in the burst activity. So if you were to increase the seismic activity in the absence of burst activity to produce this enhanced spin down, then you have to have a very large change in your distribution of energies to make them distribution of burst energies so that they wouldn't be observable.
You need a situation where the kind of events that are giving you bright bursts are not correlated strongly with the seismic activity. And one situation where you might have that is if the seismic activity is mostly due to very small events deep in the crust, and the burst events are due to larger events in which large patches of the crust can be moved, or patches of size comparable to the thickness or greater. And under that kind of hypothesis, you might have something where the spin down rate isn't closely related to the bursting activity. The persistent vibrations in the star, might not be. For one thing, the burst will release stresses over an area of the star that might normally participate in many small scale fractures. And so.
Any questions for Peter?
Yes. I expect it's pretty difficult to do because of uncertainty in the pulse period, but have you tried doing a period fold on the times of the bursts during the fast bursting activity to see if there's any phase dependent?
This is work that's been done by David Palmer. Which I haven't mentioned today. I probably should have. It's reported in the Huntsville proceedings from last year. And what he found is he grouped bursts into different intensity categories, three different intensity categories, and calculated their phase at each point. So this is from the most active burst interval right here, right after the giant flare. And he found that there was no correlation with phase. So that suggests, at least at face value, that there's... that it's a global phenomenon, a large-scale phenomenon, a large-scale emission region, not a localized phenomenon.
And the second question.
Yeah.
There must be some, I would expect, some good candidates for SGRs from the short gamma-ray bursts in the VATS database with possible IPM positions that might make good channel targets. That's up.
There are two good candidates in the BASSI database, which we found just last year, as we were, tidying up things as BASSI went down. And
these are besides the two that you just talked about?
No, these are different. Actually, there were three events. One appears to have come from 1806 minus 20, but that's not terribly important. Yeah, one from one. But there's two events which occurred on the same day, soft spectrum, consistent with the plane, and probably SGRs, but not strong enough to be detected by Ulysses, so we don't have IPN arcs. So we've got this really big 10-degree error circle, and there's lots of potential sources in there. So
these are hard spectral events, though, so they were
these are typical, well, a little bit harder than typical SGR events.
I don't know, so it's another SGR. So
probably is another SGR, SGR of a new SGR. Yeah.
Do you have the plot? Are they on the plot? The duration versus hardness?
No, I don't. I don't have that.
I think
actually, no. Maybe they are. Maybe they are in there.
Type 2 things that are confused with type 2 extra bursts. No.
Yeah, I think you're right.
I was wondering if there are any good SGR candidates in the BATSE database that could be pursued with Chandra observations.
This is the 1806 event. This is one of the potential. This is the 1806 event. This is potentially one of the new events, and this is the other one.
I'm not actually asking about ones that are from known SGRs. I'm asking about ones that
this
are
is,
from potential new SGRs.
These two are from a potential new SGR. But we've only seen two bursts, and I've searched. I've done an offline, untriggered burst search around that time interval. Found nothing, and I've searched all the triggered events in the BATSE catalog, and found no other events that were consistent with these two in terms of their spectra and temporal behavior. So we do have another SGR. We have another SGR 1801-23, which was detected only on one day. There were two bursts, very similar to this situation, except they were brighter. Two bursts, and it wasn't seen from again. This is the same sort of case where we see two bursts, except these were relatively weaker, and they weren't triggered by Ulysses, so we weren't able to get arcs.
Also, there is an untriggered event, so Jeff Commerce has done that. And basically, what we find there is that there are some very soft events that are localized in bunches, but we cannot identify. There's a huge area in the sky, what they call it. We cannot really associate them with the one.
Swift should be very good for this. Low energy band pass, very good location capability.
On top of
should be perfect.
One, which is interesting. I mean, Squares 1 does have a lot.
Fortunately, you've got a low duty cycle, so. You know, I mean, 627, you know, first, it would have been detected any time back to 1979, but obviously it never became active during that time interval, so one activity period and something greater than 20 years. A very low duty cycle, so you got to catch them at the right time, too. You had a question? This particular source is likely galactic. It's consistent with being in the plane. All the SGRs, in fact, are very well. All the galactic SGRs are very tightly constrained to the plane. Very low galactic scale heights. Not from the location of this particular SGR. Can we see them from that far away? We can probably see the giant flares. Rob actually did a calculation as to what the distance was. What was the distance you came up with?
The number I got was 13 megaparsecs. So just short of vertical cluster, about 18 megaparsecs. You can see them. There should be about 10 in the Mets. 10 in the in this plot, which would be those extra blacky things. They're very hard to identify though because they're all low fluence events. And they have big arrow boxes. With much better positions, though, we should be able to pinpoint them to positions of nearby galaxies. So the next generation of detectors, if they can really get type 2 X-ray bursts, type 2 gamma ray bursts positions accurately, as some people are claiming, maybe we'll pick up some of these things. But the best estimate is that it's just a small contamination of type 2 X-ray gamma ray bursts.
All right, I think we should. I
also want to make a comment. When we found this hard event, we thought, of course, that all these short events would seem to be different for us. Might just be the tip of the iceberg, just a very hard spike from the flare events. And we looked at them to see if they correlate with galaxies. And they don't, of course, recover. So if there are any in that group that you see there, it might be a few of them, and we cannot identify them.
I just had a short question. all magnetars appear to be slow detectors so far. Why not transfer?
I don't know. That's confusing to me.
So
but why it's such a, are you asking why it's such a tight range? Why don't we see any 20-second or 40-second or half a second?
I don't know.
Well, it's not that fast.
Yeah, lower speeds. You have a small number of sources.
So the real question is, why are they any in 100 seconds?
Yeah. So it would have to be. It would have to be only a, I mean, at least in, as far as I can see, it has to be a very narrow range in time which you can observe them. That's the only argument I can see to get that. So you can only see them during a certain time interval, and if they all spin down about the same length, then it would translate to a very narrow period range.
Okay.